Hands Across the DMZ, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The leaders of North and South Korea make history with their elaborate summit today. But in the South, many aren't quite ready to accept Kim Jong-un's charm offensive.
South Koreans have seen Kim as a monster. They've seen Kim as someone who kills family members, who runs gulag. That's all people hear about him.
And many experts here are skeptical, too.
I don't know anybody who covers North Korea, who has followed it, who thinks the North Koreans are going to give up their nuclear program just like that.
Plus, a London school bans girls under the age of 8 from wearing hijabs, angering Muslim parents.
They felt that their girls were being targeted because of their religion.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. As a piece of political stagecraft, it was stunning. The leaders of two nations, still technically at war, meet on the actual demarcation line between their two countries. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un steps across the border into South Korea, where he gets a handshake and even a hug from South Korean President Moon Jae-in. The two then wander off into the woods for a half-hour tete-a-tete.
Based on the reaction I saw in the crowd that was watching this all unfold today, everyone got a real kick out of it.
That's correspondent Jason Strother in Seoul. He says today's political theater along the DMZ was designed to get the world to rethink its image of Kim Jong-un.
Not only in American media, but also in South Korean media, the more conservative media has really demonized him, for right or wrong. I mean, after all, what do we know about him? He had his uncle publicly executed. He knocked off his elder half-brother last year. So it's this image of a monster that many South Koreans have of Kim Jong-un. And I think today, for better or worse, he was humanized.
Describe the scene for us in Seoul where you watched these events unfold. We understand some South Koreans were watching this on large screens outdoors.
That's right. I was in downtown Seoul in Seoul Plaza, where there was a big jumbo-sized television set up with live images from Panmunjom, the truce village, where President Moon and Kim met. I was with about 100 or so spectators.
I understand you spoke to one young South Korean woman. Her name is Kim Young-kyung. Let's hear what she said.
I'm so proud of our president. I've been watching the two previous presidents meeting with the North Korean leaders, but I feel a little bit different this time because the North Korean leader crossed the line to come to South Korea.
It was a bit noisy there in the square there, Jason. What was she saying?
She felt that by coming to South Korea, Kim Jong-un was showing his sincerity, that he really does want to improve relations with North and South Korea. She even took the morning off from work to come and watch that.
A lot of what we hear out of South Korea is that younger South Koreans are sort of ho-hum and kind of tired of the whole North Korea issue. Is she an outlier in her view that this is an exciting thing?
Most South Koreans are apathetic about North Korea. They regard North Koreans not necessarily as their brethren. They regard North Koreans as kind of country bumpkin cousins in a way. They speak Korean differently. They have many very different cultural values. They don't have the same education. They're very different people. And I think that's why the South Korean government, as well as media here in South Korea, really played up the significance. There was a social media campaign launched by the government. There was an effort to make this summit as festive as possible in order to get more South Koreans interested in reunification with the North.
You mentioned the horrific human rights record of North Korea. Did that make some South Koreans skeptical of this whole thing?
It certainly makes older South Koreans skeptical, South Koreans who perhaps survived the Korean War. There were protests today against the summit, and there have been. Many elderly South Koreans want nothing to do with engagement toward the North. I don't think younger South Koreans would excuse North Korea of these human rights accusations, but at least for now, they're looking the other way.
What's South Korea hoping to get out of this? I mean, what's in it for them?
Well, I think the most tangible result that came out of today's summit is that Moon and Kim announced the resumption of inter-Korean family reunions. And this is a very important issue to South Koreans. And I think when South Koreans think about human rights, they often think about the 100,000 or so South Koreans who have been waiting to reunite with family members that they haven't seen or spoken with since the Korean War.
Jason, were South Koreans surprised by Kim Jong-un's candor and humor? I mean, he acknowledged the poor road conditions in his country, saying he was kind of embarrassed about them. And, you know, he apologized for the noise of the missile tests. What did they make of that?
South Koreans have seen Kim as a monster. They've seen Kim as someone who kills family members, who runs gulag. That's all people hear about him. And I think by him coming to the South today and having this sort of, you know, chummy relationship with Moon Jae-in, like they were old friends reuniting and taking a stroll around the DMZ and cracking jokes, that was sort of Kim's part of Kim's charm offensive. He wants South Koreans to like him.
Reporter Jason Strether there in Seoul. So beyond Kim's charm offensive today, what's next for the two Koreas? One of the objectives of today's summit at the DMZ was to set the stage for a potential meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. This would be big. No sitting American president has ever met face-to-face with the leader of North Korea. There's speculation that if it happens, it could be as early as the end of May. Here's the world's Matthew Bell.
If the Trump-Kim summit is really going to happen, and if it's going to succeed, both sides have some big decisions to make. The number one issue is denuclearization. The word appeared in today's statement from the summit and sounds like a big breakthrough. But the North Koreans have said things like this before, going back to the early 1990s. Today, the North could have as many as 5 dozen nuclear warheads. Is Kim going to give them up? All of them? Some of them? How soon? And how will all of this be verified?
Essentially, this issue of denuclearization is still not clear at all.
That's James Kim with the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul. He says it looks like a Trump-Kim summit is still on track, but is it a real opportunity for success?
Opportunity for what, I guess, is the big question. Is that an opportunity for reducing tensions and walking back on de-escalation? So that we're de-escalating, we have a more stable environment, or optimistic about the likelihood of denuclearization of North Korea. I think on the latter issue, I think I'm less optimistic. On the former, there's a good possibility there that both President Trump and Kim Jong-un wishes to walk back, reduce tension around the Korean Peninsula.
When U.S. officials talk about denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, what they're focusing on, of course, is the North getting rid of its nuclear weapons and programs. When North Korea uses the phrase, James Kim says it's talking about something else.
It has implications for the nuclear umbrella that the United States provides as a deterrence against the North Korean threat.
That's a reference to the U.S. military presence in Asia. Sung-yoon Lee says the optics of today's summit were gripping. He's a professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. But Lee worries that the whole world is giving Kim Jong-un a pass.
Kim is the master impresario, and he has morphed into a global everyman, a normal dictator, a normal head of state from Rocket Man just a few months ago.
Lee says suddenly no one is talking about North Korea's gulags, its dismal human rights record, and the denial of basic freedoms to much of its population. He doubts the North is willing to give up its weapons, and he adds that nothing from today's summit gives him optimism for a summit between Trump and Kim.
Trump is walking into this elaborate trap unprepared, and I fear that President Trump will fall for that and come away from his meeting with Kim Jong-un thinking that he has tamed Kim Jong-un and thereby prematurely relaxed sanctions against Kim. We've seen this before.
Lee thinks it was a mistake when George W. Bush eased the sanctions against the North and hopes that Trump doesn't do something similar in a rush to make a grand bargain. Barbara Demick is a longtime North Korea watcher and former Asia correspondent for the LA Times. She says today's summit in Korea was a success because it reversed rising tensions between Washington and the North. Still, Demick says it's probably smart to lower expectations for a Trump-Kim summit.
I don't know anybody who covers North Korea who has followed it, who thinks the North Koreans are going to give up their nuclear program just like that. I think if it happens, it, you know, we'll start with small concrete steps, you know, leading towards a freeze. But, you know, when we play these kind of war games, what would you do if you were Kim Jong-un? You know, nobody, but nobody says, I'd give up my nuclear weapons.
The Trump administration has to decide what, if anything, it would accept from North Korea that falls short of complete and verifiable disarmament. And that's another unknown. Veteran U.S. diplomat Wendy Sherman says, yes, a U.S.-North Korea summit has the potential to be a first step towards something like a Nixon goes to China breakthrough.
Certainly, there's always that potential, but we should remember that the Nixon to China was preceded by many conversations between Henry Kissinger and the Chinese that had gone on for some time in secret before we saw that momentous moment.
As today's summit in Korea was ending, President Trump tweeted this morning, good things are happening, but only time will tell. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
As we've mentioned, the leaders of North and South Korea have now pledged to begin the process of formally ending the war between their two nations. Next, we're going to hear from a writer in the San Francisco Bay Area who grew up with that war always in the background.
My name is Joo-hyun Park. I'm 25 years old. I grew up in the Bay Area and also in Seoul, South Korea. My parents couldn't really talk about the war because in many ways their parents couldn't talk about the war because they lived it. A lot of this is stuff that I had to research on my own. If anything, the actual historical information came with a lot of silence in my family. I was kind of told matter-of-factly about probably as early as I could understand a very general outline of the last century of Korean history, particularly the Japanese occupation, followed by the Korean War and the division of Korea. So I was always aware that there was a North Korea. And it was usually communicated to me as one Korea that was divided. So when I talk about where my family's from or when I'm asked about it, a question that often comes up is, well, are you from North or South Korea? And a lot of that is based on this notion that North and South Korea are two totally distinct entities that have different heritages and different cultures, which isn't true because Korea was unified for more than 1,000 years prior to the Korean War, which was just in 1950. So when I hear that question, what that reveals to me in a lot of ways is that Korea only exists to a lot of people insofar as it concerns the United States or the West, right? And that's what I hear when I hear North or South. Are you good or bad, really? And to hear that as a kid is like an interesting thing to grow up with because I didn't really understand it in the depth so much that I just explained so much as I felt it on that level, right? Yeah, like North or South. I think I always had a lot of discomfort with the idea of Americanness because it was always something that I was kind of rhetorically cut out of, either people asking me where I was really from or like from. Like a lot of kids growing up in that context, I did adapt to that in ways where I kind of tried to make myself more acceptable, I guess. I changed my name to Matt right before third grade. I don't remember if a teacher recommended that we do it or if it was my parents' idea, but the reasoning behind that was basically that Joo-hyun was too difficult to pronounce, so I should get an English name to make it easier for everyone else, I guess. And then when I was in college, I kind of decided that I didn't really want to continue going by that name. It almost felt like a different persona in some ways, I guess. It just kind of felt like almost like a label that, you know, I needed to use, like kind of like a pass that I had to move around in the world with, but that didn't really reflect who I was. And I think a lot of that was because, you know, like it was ultimately something that I did in response to other people's discomfort.
Joo-hyun Park is a writer in the San Francisco Bay Area. You can read more from him at PRI.org. Our story was made possible by the Global Nation Reporting Fund. Coming up in a bit, activists take Facebook to task for not removing online content that's caused real-world harm. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Here's another dispatch from the culture wars. Not here, but in Britain. Since 2001, the number of Muslim students in British schools has almost doubled. Earlier this year, a school in East London actually banned girls under the age of 8 from wearing the hijab. The school argued that there's no religious requirement in Islam for very young girls to wear a headscarf, and that it's a question of gender equality. Muslim parents argued that they were being discriminated against. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil has been covering the story. Shaima, what happened at St. Stephen's Primary School in London?
Well, St. Stephen's Primary School has actually achieved an amazing feat. It went from being the 148th school to the number one school on the Sunday Times Leagues table, which is a very prestigious table to be on. And in doing so, it attracted publicity and press attention. And one of the articles that were written on it focused on a policy that was put in last September, which is to ban the hijab for girls under the age of 8. And the reason the school gave was actually health and safety. Religiously, they also argued that children, girls under 8, are religiously not obliged to wear the hijab in Islam, but also it was a matter of health and safety in the way that they played and jumped around and did PE. And so they put that policy in place. And when it came out in the press, parents were absolutely furious. They felt that they weren't consulted. They felt that their girls were being targeted because of their religion. And parents were saying, well, why are our children prevented from expressing themselves religiously? It's something that they just want to do. Why wouldn't they be allowed to do it? Why place in the policy now? And the school children as well wanted to make themselves heard. And it was important for us when we made that to hear from girls, young girls who wore the hijab. So I spoke to Sadia. She's 10 years old. She's been wearing the hijab since she was 5. She's not a student of St. Stephen's, but she is a primary school student who does wear the headscarf. And here's what she had to say.
In our RE class, we learned that some Sikh boys wear turbans and some Jewish kids wear kippah and some Christian people wear cross, like necklaces and bracelets. If you went to a bunch of kids and pick on Muslim girls only to explain why they wear hijab, they'll be discombobulated and feel worse than others.
Okay, discombobulated is a big word for a 10-year-old to use, and we did get a couple of takes of that discombobulated thing. And this was actually a part of a letter that Sadia wrote to Ofsted, which is the school inspectors here in the UK, because in light of that, they got involved. But they also were in their own kind of controversy because they announced that they were going to question young girls or ask questions of young girls wearing the hijab. And Sadia's argument and her parents' argument were, and the argument of many parents was that if you're going to go to schools and start asking young girls why they're wearing the hijabs, it is kind of targeting them and stigmatizing them. So as you can tell, it's just so complex, so sensitive, and it's easy to offend many people, whichever way you look at it.
I know you spoke to one of the activists protesting St. Stephen's ban on the hijab for children under 8. Her name's Nyla Nadu. Let's hear her.
What is wrong with a child just saying, this looks nice, I like to wear it, you know, my role models wear it, let me put it on? There's nothing wrong with that. And to prevent that, I'm not sure what it would achieve. The other side do not talk to us. They want to liberate us by speaking for us. They think they're liberating people by taking away their voice. We need women that cover to speak up for themselves.
It's very interesting because I know the
absolutely.
I know the argument made in favor of the ban is that wearing the hijab undermines gender equality in British schools. Is that the overriding view?
Well, I think it's one of the big views. When I spoke to a school principal who has a number of young Muslim girls in her school who do wear the hijab, I think she was a bit conflicted because she says, "Look, you know, personally, I don't think it's an equal practice because it's something that you are actively expecting girls to do, asking girls to do, but not asking boys to do. So there is a problem with equality there." Other people, however, say it's actually more serious than this because in asking a child to cover, you're actually sexualizing young girls. You're making them aware of their physicality when they actually shouldn't be thinking about this at all. Another argument, which was also really interesting, was the fact that some people were saying, well, you can argue that this is an innocent thing where a young girl just wants to copy her mom or her grandma or her auntie. You can argue that, you know, this is a part of their religious expression. But actually, in some cases, you are looking at a more conservative agenda that's influencing some of the schools. And what I found really interesting as well is when I spoke to Ofsted, the school inspectorate, they found material that was incredibly inappropriate in some of the schools and confiscated it. And we managed to get our hands on some of them. And, you know, if you look at some of these books, Carol, and I will say that, you know, these are not in every school. These are in some schools and they were dealt with when they were found. But, you know, we found books like, you know, with a title called Women Who Are Destined for Hell. And when you look at the chapters in the book, you know, they give you a list of what women do to go to hell. So, you know, if you cut your hair, if you expose your skin, if you imitate men. And it goes on to say that if you don't wear the veil, you don't go to paradise. So this is some of the material.
And these were books that the school itself was using?
In some schools, it was being taught to children.
Shami, you've written about your own decision to wear or not to wear the hijab in England. Did working on this story bring up anything for you?
It's hit home in a number of ways. I have a 9-year-old niece who goes to school, and she also goes to faith school sometimes, I think twice a week or something. And I remember once driving her with my sister, and then she put the little hijab on, and I looked at my sister and I said, "What's that all about?" I mean, she doesn't wear it anywhere. She goes swimming. She does, you know, she wears her shorts. She wears her bathing suit to swimming practice. Why does she wear hijab now? And she says, well, it's a thing that she wants to do. She kind of wants to mark this as a special thing where she learns Quran and she wears the hijab. And I must say, I wasn't really sure how I felt about it, but it was definitely a conversation that I was having at home. And as you rightly said, I wrote about my own experience. I used to wear the hijab. I used to wear the headscarf. And about 4 years ago, I decided that I was going to take it off. And so, you know, I kind of knew firsthand how controversial and sensitive touching that subject can be, because it wasn't easy when I did it and it wasn't easy when I talked about it. And as you can imagine, I got reactions, strong reactions from both sides of the aisle. So it was definitely present and in the back of my mind when I was doing this, because it is controversial and it is sensitive. And it goes far beyond the Muslim community here in Britain, because it's not just about British Muslims. It's about British Muslims. It's about children. It's about education. It's about integration. It's about a growing concern of Islamophobia. So it's quite a complex subject that many people are reluctant to talk about, but it's also the reason why we wanted to talk about it.
The BBC's Shaima Khalil. Thanks, Shaima.
Thanks, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills. Activists in places like Sri Lanka and Myanmar have been pushing Facebook for years to do more to remove hateful content. And now they're starting to get somewhere.
Until and unless Facebook as a company is under scrutiny in America, I don't think they care too much about what happens with the platform elsewhere.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Yesterday, we told you about how posts that went viral through Facebook in Sri Lanka led to widespread real-world violence against the Muslim minority in that country. The government there was actually forced to declare a state of emergency and temporarily block the platform, and all because of rumors packaged in a video that was posted on Facebook.
The viral post, at last time I checked, which was a couple of days ago, is still online.
Amanda Taub is with the New York Times. She spoke to us yesterday about the investigative piece she co-wrote about this issue. Today, we're going to dig a bit deeper. Some saw this sort of escalation coming long ago. They took notice as extremists got on Facebook to spread fake news and propaganda to fan already existing ethnic tensions in their country.
We first tracked it as a problem around 2013.
Sanjana Hattatua is with the Center for Policy Alternatives based in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Today we'll be hearing from him and Tent Sin, a digital rights activist based in Myanmar. In that country, Facebook has been used to incite harm against the Rohingya, a mostly Muslim minority ethnic group. Both men said they tried to get the company to pay more attention to posts that were inciting violence. When that didn't happen, Hattatua and his team in Sri Lanka took it upon themselves to monitor and aggressively report what they call dangerous content.
content that incites violence and hatred and hate against specific communities, identity groups, genders. This kind of content is very often produced and promoted and engaged with in one of my country's languages, which is Sinhalese, not spoken anywhere else. So one of the things that we've been doing over the years is to translate into English some of the content that we've been monitoring that has originally been produced or published in Sinhala.
And you send the content and translations of it to Facebook. And how have they responded?
We haven't heard anything from the company other than silence up until 3 weeks ago, when in response to an open letter signed by 13 organizations in Sri Lanka, Facebook issued a response, which we weren't too happy about, but that was the first time that the company actually responded to some of the concerns around the content that we had been flagging for years.
In all the times you flagged content and sent it to Facebook, did they ever remove the content?
Some of the content was removed on occasion. A large percentage of it was not. In fact, in March, there was an incident where public post in Sinhalese explicitly calling for the murder of a specific community, including the infants, and equating them to dogs, was by Facebook deemed to not contravene community guidelines 6 days after it was first reported. So this has been our experience over the years, where the majority of the content that has been flagged, framed, and sent to Facebook has resulted in a response much later saying that it actually doesn't contravene guidelines.
We're going to get to the community standards in a minute, but I want to bring in Tenzin. Tenzin, how long have you and fellow digital rights activists in Myanmar been putting pressure on Facebook to respond more quickly to content that could lead to violence?
We haven't, as a group of civil society, we've been trying to engage with Facebook as early as 2014. And only in the last month, we have done a more public approach by writing an open letter to them.
And have you gotten any response?
Yes, there has been back and forth between us and Facebook, and we're glad to see there are some movements, but Facebook still hasn't answered to some of the questions that we ask on handling the contents in Myanmar. And some of the posts, like in Sri Lanka, like Santana said, takes a very long time to be removed. And although some of the posts clearly violate their community standards, they were not removed. And our question is whether is it because they don't understand the context completely well, or why? What was the decision behind it?
Now, this is a question to both of you. Do either of you at this point, after all this time, understand whether the Facebook people who are responding to flagged content and evaluating problematic material, are they physically in your respective countries or not? I mean, do you even know kind of mechanically how this actually works, or are those kind of details still very vague?
Tenzin, you want to take a crack at that? I'll follow up.
Totally not. there's no transparency around this. And definitely what we've been asking for Facebook is to have someone who can actually engage with us as a Myanmar focal person so that we can help them improve their product, right? But this is something that we've been asking to Facebook, and it hasn't really happened yet. And also, we have no transparency around how many Burmese-speaking language content reviewers they have, and definitely not in the country.
Sanjana, how about you?
The same story. There is no capacity within the country, and we do not know what kind of capacity Facebook has in its company to deal with content in Sinhala. So part of our hope and expectation is that the company adds to the numbers of content reviewers who are capable of contextually determining the quality of reports that come to them from the country, and that they are, if not in the country, they are in the same time zone.
During the congressional hearings in the U.S. earlier this month, Mark Zuckerberg pledged to step up those kind of efforts to take down hate speech and other problematic content in Myanmar. Tenzin, were you encouraged by that pledge?
His pledge is to remove the contents within 24 hours although it's something unprecedented for Myanmar, it's not new. They've already done it in Germany or in other European countries, right? We welcome his commitment, and we would very much like to see how this become real.
Sanjana, how about you? What did you think of what Mark Zuckerberg pledged to do during those congressional hearings? I mean, I imagine whatever he's pledging to do for Myanmar, you would like to see applied to Sri Lanka as well.
That's quite right. Facebook seems to take a piecemeal approach to all of this. It's quite confusing as to why the company cannot adopt a more systematic, comprehensive approach to problems that are clearly plaguing the platform, not just in Sri Lanka and Myanmar, but in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in the Balkans, in Africa, in Europe, and in many other parts of the world.
Sanjana, can you just briefly try to convey to our listeners why this is so important in a place like Sri Lanka to address these issues?
The challenge in countries with a democratic deficit is that the social, political, communal, and religious fault lines, which by decades predate the advent of Facebook, are exacerbated as a consequence of millions coming onto social media in general and Facebook in particular as the primary means of communicating with each other. And that brings then their ideology, their worldview, their bias, their prejudice onto a platform which was created by an individual in a very different country, in a very different time, in a very different context for a very different projected user group. So I don't want to leave the listeners thinking that Facebook is all evil. We are not saying that. Facebook has been integral in strengthening democracy, in strengthening dissent, in creating the opportunity for critical conversations under authoritarian rule to take place. But it seems to be the case that actors are using this more and more for the promotion of the worst of society and the worst of what we can be, when all we are asking for is a very simple thing. Can Facebook help us become our better angels? That's what we want to see.
Sanjana Hatatua and Tenzin, they've been working to get Facebook to respond more quickly to violence-inciting content in Myanmar and Sri Lanka. I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We invited Facebook to join us in this conversation, but did not hear back by the time of this broadcast. Let's take a few minutes now and talk about Ken Isaacs. Who's he, you might ask? For the past 3 decades, Isaacs has helped lead a Christian humanitarian group called Samaritan's Purse. It works with refugees fleeing conflict in places like Myanmar, Rwanda, and South Sudan. But Isaacs has now been put forward for a new job, a top position at the United Nations, in fact. President Trump wants him to lead the International Organization for Migration, or IOM. It's a hugely influential UN agency with a budget topping $1 billion. But Isaacs isn't exactly a shoo-in for the UN slot. Colm Lynch writes for Foreign Policy magazine. He says Isaacs has been a bit quick with the send button on Twitter.
The Washington Post and CNN both obtained some tweets that he had made in which he had referred to Islam as an inherently violent religion. He had made a comment in which there was a need to prioritize assistance to Christian refugees in the Middle East because they had less of a chance of going back. He's been a critic of climate change, which is considered a key driver of migration. He has made comments about how the AIDS epidemic provided a great evangelizing opportunity for Christians. So he has said some stuff that have got him into hot water.
Did I read correctly that he suggested building a wall in the Alps to keep migrants out?
He did say that, and that did not play well for someone who is going to be leading the international efforts in support of migrations.
Isaacs, he's out there on an apology tour. He's touring European and African capitals with White House and State Department escorts. The State Department has produced a little video, about him to promote his candidacy. He's meeting with foreign dignitaries, including Pope Francis. What's he being asked on this tour?
He's being asked what he meant by those tweets, and he's telling them pretty much what he has been saying publicly and telling everybody else that, you know, look at the work that I have done. I have provided assistance to Muslims as well as Christians. I don't care who receives the assistance. We're primarily concerned with need. And if you look at my record, it shows that I have not been biased. And he's apologized profusely for the remarks that he has made.
How is the apology tour going over? I mean, the head of the International Organization for Migration is chosen by the UN's 169 member states, isn't it?
What I found was interesting that a number of European delegates have been telling me that they really are concerned that if they win this victory and they beat the Americans, they actually lose. They're afraid that the Americans, who pay hundreds of millions of dollars, contribute hundreds of millions of dollars to IOM every year, might cut back that support. They fear that they may retaliate in some way. And there's also concern by governments that if they field a candidate, that may damage their own sort of bilateral relationships with the United States.
You've followed the UN for many years. Do you think Isaacs is likely to get this job?
In normal times, those remarks would have been disqualifying. But one of the things I've been trying to figure out in my reporting is to what degree the negative attitude towards multilateralism that the White House has had, to what extent will that have an impact on the Americans' ability to win all these top jobs? If they denigrate multilateralism in general, how can they continue to maintain this role in leadership? And so what I have seen so far, despite the White House approach to this, they haven't really paid a price for it. I mean, as I mentioned, in the initial part of President Trump's tenure, there were threats to cut aid to UNICEF. White House appointee was, you know, given the job, nevertheless. There was also broader threats to cut humanitarian aid, including potentially food aid, and the U.S. got the top job at the World Food Program. So the Americans are getting these jobs regardless. Interesting piece of that is that a lot of those threats against those institutions haven't been carried out. So funding has actually continued for both WFP and UNICEF. In a way, the White House wasn't able to sort of carry out those cuts that they had hoped to cut. But the difference between those appointments and this one is that the UN Secretary General, who is interested in maintaining a good relationship with the United States, appointed those candidates. And in this case, it's going to be the member states. There's a lot of resentment towards the Americans, but there's a lot of sort of anxiety about taking action that might prompt the Americans to sort of withdraw from the international system even more. Late next week, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador, will host a reception at the U.S. mission to the United Nations. And I spoke to a couple of ambassadors yesterday who said, you know, basically everybody's going to be going to that. And Haley has made it clear in the past, if countries don't support American interests, that there may be a price to pay in terms of possible cuts in foreign assistance and the like.
Colm Lynch is a reporter for Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks, Colm.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Just enough time before the break for a quick look at a story we'll have for you on Monday. People in major U.S. cities are being hit by robocalls in Mandarin. Most folks hang up, but some Chinese immigrants have been scammed and talked into sending large sums of money. We talk with a New York police officer in the larceny division.
I get them also. I have an NYPD department cell phone, and I get them on the cell phones also. It is out of control.
Chinese robocalls. That's on the show Monday. And I've got Nina Porzucchi in the studio with me.
Hey, Carol.
Nina co-hosts The World in Words, our podcast about language.
So, Carol, do you have a pet?
I have three, actually.
What do you have?
Cat and two rabbits. The cat is Tan, which means black in Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
And the rabbits are named Cadbury and Houdini. We did not name them. They were a compromise. Instead of a dog, two rabbits.
I have a dog. His name is Lester. And my partner and I actually always joke that he talks to us.
I'm sure he does.
No, he does talk to us. He has these very pointed barks, and I know when he's sulking, and I know when he's, you know, telling me about his day and the latest news headlines, because, you know, we leave KCRW on for him all day. He's a very well-informed Yorkie.
I'm sure he's very informed. But what do all the howls and growls actually mean? I mean, are they a language?
This week on the podcast, that is exactly what we were talking about. Animal communication. And we have Ari Daniel from our partner program NOVA, who investigated the communication of a few different species. And I've got an excerpt for you. Everyone listening, you are going to want to turn up the bass for this.
If you're far away, you'll hear it coming in through headphones. But if you're really close to the animal, the sound is so loud that it will come out of the water You can hear it in air if you're really close, and sometimes it will actually come through the hull of the boat as well.
Ellen Garland is a marine biologist at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, where she studies humpback whale song, and it's only the male humpbacks who sing.
It's either the males who are singing to other males in sort of a male-male competition, or they're trying to sing to females to attract females in. So it's a mating display.
So you can think of these songs being made up of themes, which can be broken down into phrases, which themselves can be chopped up into units.
And we name these how they sound. Say, moan, groan, whoop, violin, bellows. So anything like that.
So each humpback whale is kind of like its own symphony?
Well, what's really interesting is that all the males within a population will be singing the same song at the same time. So they match each other. They conform to this one song type at any point in time.
So it sounds like you're saying it's less of a symphony, but more of a chorus that's all kind of got the same sheet music?
Yeah, exactly. But what's really cool is the song is continually evolving, keeps on changing over time, so units can be added or deleted, or whole themes can be inserted or deleted, and all the males make these changes within their song, and we don't know which males are leading these changes, we just know that it does change, and they all seem to conform to these changes.
Garland did some pretty groundbreaking work a few years back with humpbacks singing in the South Pacific. She was curious about how these songs were changing.
Yeah, so I listened and analyzed the songs in six different South Pacific populations over an 11-year period.
The analysis took her 3 years.
It wasn't really until the very end that the picture became extremely clear.
Here's what she found. A new song tends to start in Western Australia.
That's the biggest population in the area.
Then that song got adopted by the population in Eastern Australia.
All the males there switched their song. They learnt that song.
And the song continued traveling east.
And then the next year, it was passed on to the next population in the South Pacific.
Meaning whales in New Caledonia and Tonga.
A year later, it was then passed on into the Central South Pacific.
This song, for instance, was all the rage in French Polynesia back in 2004, but it originated in Australia a couple years earlier in 2002.
This happened multiple times where each of these populations basically threw their song type out the window and learned this brand new variation of the display.
And, I mean, that must have been exciting.
It was extremely exciting once we worked out what was happening.
So you almost kind of visualize this as a series of like kind of colored ripples radiating out over the Pacific.
Yeah, but only in a single direction.
Right, it's going west to east.
Correct.
Over a few years, a song travels over 3,500 miles, maybe even farther, due to humpbacks from across the southern hemisphere converging in the waters around Antarctica to feed each year.
There's potential for animals to interact with populations from other ocean basins. I don't know, they could pass a song type around the whole southern hemisphere. That would be amazing.
So it seems like the songs that are arising in Australia are just somehow more popular? Or how do you account for this movement?
It seems like any sort of novel song is really attractive. They really like novel songs. We hypothesize that if you've got a novel song, you might stand out against that background of other singers, and you might be that little bit more attractive to a female if, you know, you're standing out. Maybe you're more likely to get more matings. So being novel is potentially a good thing, but not too novel. They don't tend to just sing whatever they want. They tend to conform to the local song type. It's a little bit crazy, and we're still really trying to nut this out.
Not the most attractive mating call.
Not the most attractive mating call.
Yeah, but it did climb the charts of the Humpback Billboard Top 100.
But did she ever get into whether it qualifies as a language or is it just kind of mating call?
Well, we actually talk a lot about that on the podcast. If you want to hear more about humpback whale song, is it language, as well as Tungara frogs and Diana monkeys. We go into a couple different species.
Nina Porzucchi, co-host of the World in Words podcast. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Nina.
Thanks so much, Carol. And for folks who are interested in learning even more about animal communication, NOVA has a 6-part special on the topic. It's called NOVA Wonders, What Are Animals Saying? And you can find it on pbs.org/NOVA Wonders.
If I could talk to the animals, I'd just imagine it chatting with a chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. Oh, what a neat achievement it would be.
Seems like the perfect spot to leave it for today. Our own non-whale-related theme music is composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
I would converse in polar bear and python. I would curse in fluent kangaroo. If people ask me, can you speak rhinoceros, I say, of carceros. Can't you? Conferred with our furry friends, man to animal, think of the amazing repartee. If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals, grunt, squeak, just walk with the animals, and Lord, they could talk to me.
PRI, Public Radio International.